Hi, Ta-Nehisi.
Hey, Megan, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Still wishing I was in Aspen, but, you know, those are the breaks, I guess.
I'm kind of happy to be back. I was driving around D.C. thinking, you know, when I was in the cab, I was just like, I love D.C. I'm so happy to be back in my city.
I keep looking up, waiting to see that mountain.
Yeah.
It's never there.
You can't beat the scenery. You've got some sort of, like, you know, quasi-mountains there, right? The canyons of Wall Street?
Yeah, I guess. But you know what's funny? Ever since I started freelance, I never make it below, like, 110th. Except the jog. I go down, you know, to the park and go, except that I really don't go downtown too much. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's hard to get out of your house. Like, someone video chatted me, like, a week ago, and he talked to me for about 2 minutes, and he looked at me, he's like, it was about 6 o'clock in the evening, and he was video chatting from his office. He was like, you're still in your pajamas, aren't you? I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I'd have a joke I'd make at Kenyatta's expense, but it'd be embarrassing, and I will refrain. I'll tell you when we're not video blogging.
Yes.
I will gladly repeat the joke for you. I'm sure.
We both love Kenyatta way too much to make jokes at her expense in public.
Yes. Okay. So what are we doing here? Where are we starting?
So let's start by introducing ourselves. I'm Megan McArdle. I write and blog for the Atlantic Monthly. And you're Ta-Nehisi Coates, and you...
Yeah. What do I do? No. I'm Ta-Nehisi Coates. I freelance, and I write for the Atlantic Monthly when I'm lucky enough. Other times, I guess I blog for myself and write for whatever publications will have me.
And you have a new book coming out.
I have a book that came out in May called
That Struggle. Counts as a new book coming out. You know, it's a new book out.
It's a new book out. Okay. It's called The Beautiful Struggle. It's a memoir of me, my dad, and my older brother. And there is a very nice, not that anybody cares, but I'm just going to plug myself, a very nice LA Times profile about the book that's out today.
You should absolutely never miss a Blogging Heads opportunity to plug your book.
I don't think I can.
Well, this is kind of an interesting, the title is like a good segue into our first topic, which is peer groups and obesity.
Yes.
What we might call the beautiful struggle of America right now.
Yes.
You had some thoughts on this. You basically said you lost a bit of weight in Aspen.
I did. Well, I don't know how much I lost at Aspen, but one of the interesting things is when I came to New York, I was roughly 90 pounds overweight, okay? And I had been living in Delaware before that. And I think as anybody with kids will say, one of the things that happens when you have children is you just, I mean, it's really sad, but I think you pay much less attention to yourself, like right off the bat. You know, I guess it's
not sad. I don't know if that's sad.
Yeah, it's pretty natural, isn't it?
I hope.
It's only sad from the perspective that we like to think we can do both, you know? I mean, I guess there's this romantic idea, you know, about what can be done and what can't. Anyway, so I felt pretty badly out of shape. And so we came to New York, me and Kenyatta, when Samari was 1 year old. And at that point, by the point I decided that something needed to change, I was about 90 pounds or so overweight. And the interesting thing about that for me was that it wasn't out of any sort of health concern, but I'm sure, you know, somebody as a native New Yorker, you can understand this. New York is not comfortable for fat people at all. I mean, it's a great argument for losing weight, actually. I mean, it's just so many things. I mean, I think it's the size of the restaurants, the fact that you have to walk so much, the subway, the buses. It's a very uncomfortable place to be overweight. And so shortly after I got here, I immediately, you know, lost, you know, some of that weight right off the bat, you know, about 50 or 60 pounds.
Were you trying, or did you just lose it sort of
osmotically? No, I was trying. I was trying, and I had to, you know, I had to try. I actually joined Weight Watchers. It wasn't like anybody made fun of me or anything like that. Like, it's not like in the movies where people point at you. I can't even say people treated me different, you know, I probably attracted more attention from women before than I do now, you know. So it wasn't like that. It just was really, really uncomfortable. It was just all the little things. As I said, the small restaurants, you know what I mean? Having to walk so many more places, you know what I mean? Having to fit into, you know, the subway. Just little tiny things like that made it really, really uncomfortable. And I think also just people who I knew here, they just ate less. You know, like nobody, suddenly nobody I knew really ate Dunkin' Donuts? I mean, it was just the weirdest thing, you know? So, one of the things that I noticed when I was in Aspen, you know, hanging out with you guys is, and this is crazy, but no one finished their plate. Like, no one, like, it was just the weirdest thing. I mean, when we were at the really formal dinners, people would actually come around and take your plate. And one of the points Kenyatta made was that when she's worked at Pizzeria Uno's, and she's also worked at Fine Dining. I guess I should tell everybody, Kenyatta's my partner, 10 years, and also the mother of my very, very beautiful son, Samari. So if you hear me mention her, that's who I'm talking about. But she was saying when she worked at Pizzeria Uno's, they would, you know, come out and serve these really big plates. And the rule was you never took anybody's plate before they were done. Okay, because that was, like, just the worst thing. You just made sure they better be, you know, had scraped that plate completely clean before they took it. But when she worked in fine dining, the rule was, you know, you took the plates and kept the courses moving. You know, like, there was not, you know, the same sort of prohibitions on that. So when we were at these big dinners, obviously, I mean, a lot of times people just didn't finish. I mean, I remember when they served dessert. They served, and I feel completely ghetto talking about this. I'm so unacculturated. But, like, when they served desserts, you know, a lot of times, you know, it'd be a cobbler of some sort, and it'd be a really small cobbler, and a scoop of ice cream that couldn't have even been a half a cup. And I noticed from, you know, just doing Weight Watchers and everything. And, you know, I wasn't so much indignant as just amazed. And most people did not finish their desserts, which immediately put a sort of pressure on me to not finish my dessert, which I did not. And did not feel like cheated or anything about it. And then after I was done, I walked away. You know, I was remarkable. It was like, like, I expected, I guess, to feel like, oh, man, I got to go to, you know, McDonald's now. Even, you know, I don't eat McDonald's or anything. There is a McDonald's in Aspen. I did notice that.
There was nothing. No fast food.
No, there wasn't. There was one McDonald's, but that was it. Me and Kenyatta noticed the last day we were there. But there really was no fast food. You're right about that. But I felt like, I, you know, like, when I finished, it wasn't like I felt like I wasn't full or anything like that. And so, you know, one of the things that I was just thinking about, you know, once I got back was just how much, you know, how does culture and peer group play into how we eat? I mean, how many of us, you know, like me, come from families where, you know, we were taught by parents who, you know, came up in, you know, poverty themselves that, look, you eat every last bit on your plate. I mean, that's something I wouldn't say to Samari. I wouldn't say that to my son. You know, I don't say that to him. You eat every last. I mean, I stress eat your vegetables, but beyond that, I certainly don't say, you know, scrape your plate every last little bit. You know, he's not in a culture now in which, like, I would look at him and say, boy, you're too thin. You need to eat more. You know what I mean? Where I think a lot of us sort of come from that place. And so that was just an interesting observation I had.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, I actually, you know, my mom, I grew up in Manhattan, but still, I have to say, I go shopping with my mother, and partly because I'm a vegan, which is, it's hard to gain weight as a vegan. So my mother actually does. It's like she's trying to fatten me up for the slaughter. She's, you're too thin. You're going to die. But in general, no. I remember when a couple years ago, my mother and my sister and I went on a cruise. And I'd never done this before. You know, my family didn't really vacation when I was growing up because we didn't – like, basically all my parents' money went into educating us. So we didn't – the first vacation I took with my mother that was, like, to a place that wasn't relatives was basically this trip. And so we went on this cruise of the Greek islands, which was great. It was like a sailing ship and it was little, but you know, most of the people there weren't from New York. They weren't necessarily from urban areas. And the thing that I noticed was the food on the cruise ship wasn't very good. It was European and it was just sort of like, what a friend of mine in London used to call stuff with white sauce. It was just everything was sort of custardy and the salad wasn't good. And there was, so I would, they would have, you know, it was like all you can eat. You could get everything, multiple courses, but the food wasn't good. So I didn't want to eat even as much as they would, you know, even the minimum.
Right.
And people would look at me like, you're not going to get dessert.
And I
would say, no, you know, it doesn't really look that appealing. And they'd be like, but you're paying for it.
Right.
And you know, this cruise cost a fantastic amount of money. Like, it cost my sister and I to share a room $1,500 a piece, or more than that. So, like, $1,800 a piece just to share a room for a week on this thing, and that didn't include airfare. So all of the people on this cruise are incredibly affluent, but there's some attitude, you know, that isn't in New York and that is in most of the rest of America, like, that big portions equal good portions, and also that, like, if they serve it, you should finish it because that's really getting value for money. And there's a totally different cultural expectation in New York, and to some extent, I think in California and D.C. that, like, I love European restaurants because I can almost never finish an entire American restaurant portion unless I'm really starving, and usually after I finish it, I don't feel that good. So, like, I like that like European New York thing of smaller portions, but I think that there's a real cultural norm about that stuff, and I think it does. I mean, I gained weight when I moved from New York to D.C., and then I became a vegan mm-hmm. and I lost it. But there is, you have to adjust, I think, to the, you know, people. The interesting thing at The Economist was everyone who moved from London to New York would gain weight because the portions were so much bigger. But everyone who moved from New York to London would gain weight because the food was so much heavier. Mm. Like, there's not nearly as much light food available in London. And so, you know, part of it is just adjusting yourself to the environment you're in. Mm-hmm. But part of it, I also think, is that there's enormous peer pressure in New York to be thin.
Yeah. Now, I wonder, as a woman, did you encounter it in a different way? Like what I'm saying is, it wasn't so, like, I didn't feel it overtly. I mean, I wonder whether there's more overt pressure on women.
Well, I mean, I think it just starts out in New York with the fact that, like, things are small. Mm-hmm. You don't take cabs most places. You have to walk or take the train, and fitting yourself into a seat, you know, the seats are made for someone who's sort of, like, normal to slightly overweight. They're not made for anyone who's really heavy.
Right.
The walking helps a lot, and I think the kind of foods that are available, like, there's just a lot of salad bars and so forth all over that in D.C. definitely don't exist. It's a lot harder mm-hmm. to just go out and, like, grab, you know, like, an awesome salad from somewhere.
Right.
But there's also, yeah, for women, there's definitely, you know, I went to private school in New York, and I would say that easily half of my class had pretty major eating disorders.
Right.
And also, like, you know, I was at a party, you know, I was at a party, sorry, I'm readjusting my headset, I think I'm a total idiot, but I was at a party after, like, between the time when I sort of got transferred to D.C. and when I actually moved to D.C., and so I gained, like, 5 pounds, whatever. So I probably weighed 155 pounds, which for someone who's 6'2" is not a huge amount, is not a huge amount to weigh. And this woman came up to me at a party. I was at some fundraiser, and I'm chatting with this woman who's one of these, like, Nan Kempner Society raiser women.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Oh, you should try this spa. I was just at, they're amazing. You could lose 30 pounds in a month." And I was like, I don't want to lose 30 pounds at all, much less in a month. It sounds repulsive. But, you know, this is, like, for women, it is definitely, and it's weird to leave New York and leave urban areas and see how much heavier people are outside. It's so easy to be, and, like, there's all those things, like, you know, the all-you-can-eat buffets that are all mm-hmm. over everywhere except New York.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not a kind of restaurant in New York.
So I wonder, as a card-carrying libertarian, when we talk about solutions, what your analysis is from that perspective?
Well, I mean, okay, so there's a video, or part of a video, that's going to go up with me and Paul Campos, and I think part of it is, honestly, like, we overemphasize thinness in our culture. And I'm certainly, like, I, like every other American woman, sort of feel subtly like my life would be way better if I just lost 5 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
In no particular way, just, like, everything would be slightly better. And I don't think I'll ever get over that. But I think rationally, in fact, the health costs of being what we define as overweight or even obese are not well proven. The health drawbacks of being morbidly obese, of having a BMI of, like, 40, are really well proven. And those people, you know, they need help with thing, you know, whatever, gastric bypass or some other. But the people who are below that, it's not actually clear. Like, being underweight is more dangerous than being mildly overweight. You're more likely to die from the mortality. But we've defined, you know, I'm, like, on the very outside edge of what's defined as kind of normal in our society by the media, right? Like, what if I were an actress, I would have to lose 15 pounds probably to sort of keep my jobs.
Right.
And I'm really pretty skinny. So the idea that that I'm at the outside of what we've defined as normal. I mean, I'm a freak. I'm 6'2", I weigh now 145 pounds, and, like, that's really, and I have a BMI of 18 point something. I mean, that's mm-hmm. absolutely abnormal. Almost no one looks like me, and almost no one can look like this over the age of 19. I'm not saying that, like, I'm amazingly gorgeous. In fact, I think that being that thin isn't really particularly attractive to men. Women think it is. But we've defined that, and so women strive for it, and they spend so much time going to Weight Watchers and so forth, and I think that it's spilling over to men now. I see men now who do things that I used to associate with women, such as refusing to buy something if the size is too big, as if, you know, as if being somehow, as if squeezing into an 8 makes you thinner, rather than just acknowledging that you're a 10.
And I
think it's really unhealthy that we're doing this, because people spend phenomenal amounts of time and energy trying to get down to really unrealistic goals for sort of 98% of the population. Like, my BMI is in the 2%
right.
of the population, like on the sort of normal distribution curve.
Right.
So you've got 98% of women in America who are being told that they should get their BMI to somewhere near where mine is, and that's crazy.
So wait, I want to take you back to a point you were making, though. So do you think that this whole idea of the obesity crisis in America is overblown a bit?
I think it is way overblown. I think that, you know, I think it's a fixation of the upper middle class. And I think it's really interesting, if you look, there's actually kind of a myth that America used to think that heavy women were attractive. This is actually kind of true. If you look at this woman who was like the it girl of the 1880s, she weighed like 200 pounds.
Right.
But among the upper classes, being thin was always valued. I used to say when I was an English major, like, the ideal Victorian woman is dying of consumption.
Right.
She's extremely thin and wan and tends to faint a lot.
How old is this? Was this true like 400 years ago? Like, if you
were in Europe
or anything?
I don't know about 400. Certainly in the upper class, in the 200 years, it goes back. The upper classes valued slenderness.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've more and more, as the media has become more mass media, we've transmitted that belief to everyone. Although I will say that still, right, like, Black and Hispanic women and some white ethnic communities are much more comfortable with being overweight than white women.
Yeah, it's and that's another interesting thing. Before I came to New York, I had like, my taste in women, even though Kenyatta doesn't look like this, I'm almost embarrassed to admit this. My taste of women probably leaned more to the taste of the porno industry, just in terms of proportionality.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but that wasn't true of my male friends who had come up in New York. And the crazy thing is, I've actually been influenced by them. Like, I think I've actually shifted into the other direction. I mean, again, sort of going back to this point of peer pressure. I don't know, peer pressure is probably not the wrong word. But how culture shapes you, you know, you're around people long enough and you start, you know, maybe starting to see things through their eyes. I mean, I don't know, like, my whole, you know, I can definitely relate to what you're saying about, you know, different ethnic communities seeing things differently. But as you transition and move into other classes, I think maybe your values change for, you know, good or ill also.
Well, I think that ultimately what a lot of this is about class. Is mm-hmm. if you look at you know, again, sort of accepting the medical definitions of overweight and obese, which Paul Campos quarrels with and I might also quarrel with. But accepting that, if you look at overweight and obesity, it's extraordinarily strongly correlated mm-hmm. with poverty. So mm-hmm. if you're poor, you're about twice as likely to be heavy as you are if you're wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I went to this this panel at Aspen on the obesity crisis in America, which included Paul Campos, which is why I interviewed him, saying there's no crisis. It's not that big a deal.
Mm.
We're living more sedentary lives. We have more food availability. Our weight is naturally going to rise, and that's not really going to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
And we should adjust our ideas of beauty to that rather than trying to adjust... adjust our weights to this completely unrealistic idea of beauty, which is getting thinner and thinner every year. That's the crazy thing. As we get fatter, we're getting more obsessed with being thin.
Right.
But, like, it ended up being a bunch of wealthy, mostly white people sitting around, upper middle class, highly educated, kind of sitting around going, aren't fat people terrible? And they're stupid, and they don't know what they're doing, and it's awful that they're fat, so how can we trick them into stop being fat? You know, like, and I actually, the libertarian, ended up getting up and giving this sort of impassioned rant about paternalism. And I think that this is really, you know, poor people aren't stupid. They know that McDonald's isn't good for you and that
we talked about this and that whole, you know, thing with McDonald's putting the calorie count up there. I highly doubt people are going to, you know, stop. The funny thing is, I went to the movie theater like maybe a couple of weeks before I came out to hang out with you guys. And, me and a buddy of mine went to see Iron Man, and there was a brother working behind the behind the counter. And, you know, they had the all the calories for the popcorn and everything. And so I said to him, I said, look, is this really making a difference? And he said, no, it's not making a difference at all. Then he looked and saw that there was nobody behind us, and he leaned in really close to us, and he said, it's making a difference for white people. Like that. So we got a great laugh about that. But no, you know, the one thing I would quarrel with is one of, and you know, maybe there's completely no correlation at all in terms of this, but taking the buses in Harlem. And I think there was a piece on this about just how, you know, especially in East Harlem, the large number of people who have diabetes. You see so many people who have legs amputated or whatever, you know, who are suffering the effects of diabetes. And, you know, you also see, you know, this large number of overweight people. And maybe there's no correlation at all, but, you know, somewhere in the back of your mind, you're like, Jesus, oh, my God, we really have got to eat better, you know.
But maybe I'm conflating
two things here.
Yeah, I mean, this is the difference, is that diabetes is correlated with having a really quite high BMI.
Right.
But it's also that, you know, you can eat better without getting thin. But most people say they say I'm exercising to be healthy, I'm eating right to be healthy. But this is not true for most people. They're doing it to be thin. And also that things like yo-yo dieting can actually make things like diabetes worse, apparently. Or this is at least is again what Professor Campos argues. So I guess I would say I agree with you. If you have diabetes, you need to manage it better, right? You need to manage what you eat, and you should be, you know, you should be managing that before. You should, you know, we shouldn't eat so much sugar. We shouldn't eat, because those things do give people diabetes.
Right.
And I think that actually, like, one of the things that I would like to see is I think our farm policy pushes high fructose corn syrup into the food chain at just ridiculous levels, and that's probably contributing to the rise.
Right.
So I'm not quarreling with the idea that people should be healthier.
Right.
I'm sort of quarreling with the idea that what we've defined as healthy is ridiculously unrealistic. And if you get people who are all striving, right, it's like Charles Corellis is doing this stuff on poverty where he says, you know, if you have one dent in your car, you get it fixed because it makes the car look bad. If you have 50, you know, you're not going to fix any of them because it just seems hopeless. And I think that by setting up this completely unrealistic vision of what people are supposed to look like, you know, for someone who's 250 pounds, if you said lose 20 pounds, you know, which might help their diabetes, that's an achievable goal. If you say to them, you have to lose 100 pounds, and until you lose 100 pounds, you're not going to be healthy, that, I think, is what we've set up, and that is not realistic for most people, and it means that they don't even start trying to do the things that they could do.
Right.
I think, you know, I mean, I'm not against things like labeling. You know, as a libertarian, I think the government should provide transparency. So more information is great, and, you know, give people labeling. But when people started talking about things like how we were going to sneak down portion sizes so that people didn't realize that it was happening. You know, I'm just sort of like, well, who the hell do you think you are, Miss Thing?
Right. So did you like Super Size Me? What was your opinion on Super Size Me? Just curiosity.
I mean, I think in some, it's interesting, but no one eats that way. You know, I mean, like, if you do something really bizarre and extreme,
then yes.
But, like, I've worked on construction sites, and they don't eat that way. And these are people who work, like, heavy hours, and they eat badly. They eat crap. But they don't eat that badly. And, you know, I think this idea, like, I can't remember who was saying this, as, you know, he said about the supersizing fries. This was this incredible revolution where they say, you want fries with that, and that adds 400 or 500 calories to your meal, and people know there are French fries.
Right.
But, you know, maybe I forgot that I wanted French fries. You know, like, I have a big order. This seems really silly. Like, people also know if they don't want French fries, and they're not caused by some psychic mind power of being asked whether they want them to buy fries that they don't want to consume.
So,
I'm just, I'm really skeptical of this idea that, like, the upper middle class, that everyone in America, I think this is, goes much more broadly than obesity. But we've set up this idea that everyone in America is supposed to look and act like the upper middle class. And until that happens, things aren't right in the world. And, you know, in some things, I think that that's true, right? I think everyone in America should have equal educational opportunities, the upper middle class, and so forth. But on things like, whether they choose to eat McDonald's or not, I'm all for giving people more information, but I am not for trying to, like, trick people into doing what I think is healthy for them.
Are you for mandating that restaurants have to give people more information?
Sure, but the thing that I am against is the way New York has done it, which is that they've only done it for chains.
Right.
So the restaurants rich people go to don't have to do this.
Right.
Because then they couldn't have access to their specials and so forth because it would be too hard to calculate the calorie counts. It's only the recipes that poor people go to. And so I think that that's problematic. I think that, you know, if you're going to do the calorie counts, it should be across the board.
Right.
Everyone has to do it or no one has to do it.
So from a business perspective, I never understood why there was so much of a fight over it, though, because, I mean, this is just, I could be completely ignorant about this, but if I owned a McDonald's, I don't think people come to McDonald's for the salad. Like, I think if I order the double Whopper with supersized fries, I mean, and I enjoyed supersized, I mean, so I guess, you know, I found it interesting. I did enjoy it. I thought some of the points in it, you know, made were pretty good, but I think, I could pull somebody over on 125th and say, hey, if you eat McDonald's every day, and that's the only thing you eat for 30 days, what do you think will happen to your body? Yeah, I think they'll say, yeah, I don't expect good things to happen there.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, I think, I guess I can talk from the man. When I lived in Delaware, I think we ate pretty badly. What we were shocked by, and what I was shocked by when I went into Weight Watchers, was what your daily caloric count should be. That was shocking to me, and how far over it I was. That was shocking. But I didn't think I was eating well before. Like, I didn't think I was being healthy before, you know? So.
And again, like, I think that education on that, you know, would be great. Fine.
Right.
The government should educate you about what your caloric needs are likely to be.
Right.
And I think the restaurants fight it for a lot of reasons. One is that they want you to buy the supersized fries, and another is actually just that they, you know, at McDonald's, what they're talking about is putting it at the on the display, and that just takes up display space that they would like to use to advertise more things.
Gotcha.
But it means that, you know, it makes it harder to introduce new foods or whatever. But I think in general, first of all, businesses are just conservative. They fight anything reflexively. I don't think it'll make much difference. And I don't think McDonald's thinks it'll make much difference. I don't think anyone really thinks it'll make much difference. Because as you say, like, the only people who are actually affected by this are the same people who comb the websites to find out exactly what the calories are in a Starbucks, you know, triple mochaccino with...
Which I have done, by the way.
I've done it, too. I've done it in part because I had an argument with my boss about how many calories were in, like, a skim milk latte. But but, you know, I do it, too. Like, I, you know, because I'm one of these obsessed New York people who thinks that everything that goes in my mouth is some sort of, like, sacramental act.
Right.
But, you know, like, my great-grandmother never heard of a calorie in her entire life. She knew what made you, you know, she knew what kind of food made you fat and what kind of food didn't. And it's the same foods we say make you fat now. So I think that it's overblown, the idea that it's an informational problem. I think what it comes down to is that, in fact, I'm kind of interested. I don't have a solution for this. I'm very interested in this idea of, like, hyper-palatability. The food companies have gotten so good at making food taste good that it's triggering these sort of, like, ancestral reptilian hormonal things that are basically ratcheting the set point upward, the weight that your body wants to maintain. And most people are set so that set point will rise, and then some people just aren't. You know, like, I'm probably one of those people. My appetite, if I overeat, I feel sick. And I will not eat for the next day. You know, like, I know that if I have a big meal the night before, I won't be able to eat until sort of afternoon the next day. My mom's the same way. My grandfather, like, it's clearly inherited. Like, my ex-boyfriend was, it didn't matter what he ate. He was a rail. You know, he weighed, like, 140 pounds sopping wet. And then, you know, most other people aren't that way. He was much more extreme than me.
Right.
And most people aren't that way. And so, you know, you're going to get into a situation where food, the stuff tastes good. I can't eat a McDonald's anymore, but McDonald's French fries are delicious. I don't care what Michael Pollan says. They're awesome.
Yeah.
And,
you
know, I was pretty fond of the Big Mac, too. And, like, so I don't know how you get around the fact that, you know, the stuff that tastes good isn't particularly good for us. But actually, I have hope in the sense that you've seen this, right? We both grew up in urban neighborhoods where there was a like, fairly high concentration of poverty.
Yes.
And the grocery stores of my youth, compared to even the grocery store that was in the housing project across the street from me when I was living on 95th Street a couple of years ago, just night and day. There's just more stuff, you know, the roast chickens and all the little, the pet red canned peppers and jars and so forth. The supermarkets are just getting better, and they're making lower-calorie food, like lower-calorie, really tasty food, just available to more people over time. So I think that, you know, we may just hit a peak where people's eating habits start to change, because, as you say, it's not comfortable to be 350 pounds anywhere. It's right. just harder. And so people, even if no one is looking at you, no one's being mean, which I think does really happen and is a tragedy, the way fat people are treated in America. But even if you're not doing that, it's, you know, it's hard to get into airplane seats, and it's bad for your knees and so forth. So I think we'll probably just hit a point where, you know, most it sort of maxes out, and America's eating habits slowly change because people don't want to be that heavy. But mm-hmm. I don't think that we're ever going to get to a point where everyone in America looks like Jennifer Aniston. And I'm not sure that I think that's a real tragedy.
Will we get to, like, Paris? Will we be like Paris?
Well, they're getting fat. I mean, like, the thing that amazes me is that, in fact, like, Spain is heavier than America is now. Which is shocked me. Yeah. You hear about the Mediterranean diet. Mm-hmm. Which may be... Maybe a good time to segue over to environmental policy and economics.
Yes, I'm sorry. We ran really long on this, didn't we? I feel like we took up the whole 40 minutes talking about this.
Oh, no. We're still
we're at a half an hour, I've just been told. Jesus Christ. Woo!
Well, man. It's a free-form jazz odyssey. That's what blogging is all about.
Okay, that's a beautiful thing. So, I look, this is going to be weird because I'm basically going to ask you questions because this is not my area. I hope to make it my area. There's so many things in the world to know. But obviously this has been getting a lot of attention lately. And I've been following on your blog, been following on Nat's blog. So why don't I open it up to you? How about that?
Well, I mean, what do you want to know? Like, you need to ask me something.
Okay, I do need to ask you something.
Economics
can I start with just completely stupid questions? Can I start there?
Absolutely. There's no such thing as a stupid question.
The other day, I saw the term cap and trade. I actually had to Wikipedia it to get, you know, any idea of even what it was. So I wonder what your opinion as the economics person is of cap and trade.
Okay, so this is pretty interesting, actually, because it's sort of a raging debate in the economics community. Now that I think most people have conceded that global warming is an issue that we should address.
Right.
The great news for libertarians is that I think 20 years ago we would have been hearing about, oh, we have to, like, go and just, you know, regulate the hell out of what everyone does and mandate X, Y, and Z technology. But we've had a revolution in the way that we think about these problems, and instead of trying to get these sort of heavy-handed government regulations, instead what we look for is market-based regulations, is market-based solutions to take care of what an economist would call a negative externality. So mm-hmm. an externality is anything, if I'm doing anything, it's an effect that isn't on me, it's on someone else. So if I'm watering my lawn and it sprays over onto your lawn and washes your begonias away, that would be a negative externality. Mm-hmm. In economics, pollution is a negative externality, usually. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is, right, that people aren't paying the full cost of their actions. And so what mm-hmm. you want to do with this is that you want to make people internalize those costs. Mm-hmm. And there's two approaches that you can take to that. There's a carbon tax, and there's what's called cap and trade.
Okay.
So the idea behind cap and trade is the tax is, you know, pretty simple, right? You just levy a flat tax on however much carbon emissions.
Right.
On the cap and trade side, you say, here is as much emissions as America is going to do. Mm-hmm. And we're going to allocate permits, and people are going to basically be able to trade those permits between them. And the idea behind that is, right, some people are going to be able to reduce their carbon emissions much more cheaply than other people. And you want those people to be doing the bulk of the reductions. Mm-hmm. And so once you've allocated those permits, the people who find it very expensive to reduce their carbon emissions will basically buy the permits, and the people who find it cheaper will sell them.
Right.
So there are some interesting issues with it. In theory, if you know everything, a tax and cap and trade are identical. Mm-hmm. So if I know basically the total externality, the amount of emissions I want to get to, and the value of those emissions to other people, I can either have cap and trade or tax, and they will behave in completely identical ways.
Okay.
The situation we have, though, is, right, we don't really know what the negative externality is. We're still arguing just about what the cost of, you know, how much global warming is going to happen, much less than what the cost of that is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
We're still arguing about things, you know, sort of philosophical economic issues, like how should we value poor countries versus things that happen to poor countries versus things that happen to rich countries? How should we value things that happen to future generations versus things that happen now? You know, how do you discount for the uncertainty and so forth? So the approach that we're going to get in the United States, I favor a tax for a couple reasons. I think that the auditing, we are not at a point right now where we can successfully audit carbon emissions very well.
And that's just, and you're talking from a technological perspective?
Yeah, we are technologically not very good at auditing carbon emissions, and we're much less good at auditing offsets. So one of the ways in which people are supposed to, you know, do these carbon reductions, right, is that you can sell something called an offset. And I don't know if you've heard about, like, TerraPass. Mm-hmm. The idea is you fly and you pay them to plant a tree, and that's supposed to take the carbon out of the air that you generated by flying.
Okay.
Offsets are really problematic. So calculating, the problem is, like, you need to calculate sort of, like, in an alternate universe where they hadn't planted that tree, what right. would the carbon net carbon have been? And those calculations are incredibly hard to make, and especially when you get into doing international trading. So right. what's happening with Europe is they're going into, say, China and saying, you've got this plant that emits some incredibly powerful greenhouse gas. I will pay you $700 million. There's actually a case like this. I'll pay you $750 million to shut it down. Now, this caused quite a scandal because, in fact, it turned out that it cost the people who shut it down, like, less than $50 million. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they made this gigantic profit. I don't have a problem with that. The problem is, if you can make gigantic profits on having profitable plants for people to shut down, you're giving people an incentive to keep open their polluting plants or even build new ones in order to get paid to shut them down.
Gotcha.
And so, like, we don't have any good way at all of auditing those offset things. I think the calculations are so indeterminate that if you include offsets in a carbon trading scheme, it's basically going to break down and it's not going to result in significant emissions cuts. Now, okay. I talked to Austin Goolsbee this weekend about this, and he pointed out, you know, this is also true of taxes, as long as what you're really trying to tax is carbon emissions. And so what I would say is that what we need instead of a carbon tax is a source fuels tax, because we know basically how much carbon is included in a pound of coal or a gallon of oil or a cubic foot of natural gas. If you tax that, and then you can slowly start working offsets in, right? Like, start having people work on carbon sequestration schemes for coal plants and so forth, and introduce those gradually where we have good auditing, where we're really sure that what we're doing is on net reducing carbon emissions. But until that point, I think that, you know, a cap-and-trade plan, my problem with it basically is just that I think the auditing is so problematic that I'm not sure it's going to do much good, and I would much rather see us just levy sort of a stiff tax on oil, natural gas, and coal.
So, but no matter who becomes president, we're going to have something, right? I mean, that's pretty
yes.
much where we're headed.
Think no matter who becomes president, we're going to have something. The basic conflict between McCain and Goolsbee was my professor. He's Barack Obama's economic advisor. He was my professor at Chicago, so I tend to just identify him. It's as if Barack Obama were just the front man for the for the Goolsbee band.
Right.
But in fact, like, the basic argument between Obama and McCain right now is between whether you auction the permits for emissions or whether you so you would sell them off to the highest bidder, or whether you allocate them to people who are sort of existing emitters.
Mm-hmm.
And Goolsbee's argument over and over again in Aspen, he was asked this question sort of like 8 times on various panels, is that the problem with not auctioning them is that you open up sort of large opportunities for corruption, and you're favoring insiders over outsiders.
Wait, I'm sorry, Megan, you got to repeat that. It's raining here. Sure. It just started thundering. It literally thundered as you was explaining that. Sorry.
God is punishing me for speaking out against John McCain's carbon plan, clearly. It's actually interesting because this is the interesting thing with auctioning is that it's framed as who gets, you know, whether consumers or companies get the money.
Okay.
And in fact,
okay.
it's not. It's basically whether the government or companies gets the money, because the consumers,
okay.
no matter what, these markets are so scarce that the market price is basically just being set by how much people are willing to pay for fairly fixed supplies of the stuff.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm vaguely neutral between those two things. I think that, you know, to get political support for it from the companies, we're going to have to be on board for this, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them lobbying. you'll probably do better just giving the permits out. But I think Goolsbee is also right that you've got a lot of opportunities for corruption with that. You're going to get frantic lobbying. You're going to, you know, it's going to turn the bill into a lobbying fest. And that's going to be true anyway. I mean, people are going to be in Washington. But there's a lot more opportunities if you're giving away the permits than if you're selling them to the highest bidder. I mean, the other nice thing is, theoretically, if you sell them to the highest bidder, you could use that to give money back to people. But I think that that's really unlikely. I think the government will take it and spend it on some idiotic project. But so that in a nutshell is the argument. We're going to get something. Who gets elected? Basically, the big quarrel is just whether we're going to auction these permits off. Well, how stiff the caps are going to be, I think, and also whether we auction them off or whether we give them out.
It's just fascinating to me that this isn't even really a debate anymore. I mean, like whether or what we're going to do, you know, how quickly the political terrain has shifted on that.
You know, I'm hopeful because I'm not a global warming skeptic and I'm in favor of doing something, although as I say, I'm in favor of a source fuels tax. Mm-hmm. I do still question whether we're actually going to do something or whether we're going to have this cap and trade scheme and then the offsets are going to be set up in such a way that, like, they don't really cause much economic pain and therefore also don't really cause much reduction in emissions. And okay. I think that's just something that you sort of... I mean, in Europe, the result of the cap-and-trade scheme has so far been really completely disappointing. And I keep being told by people, oh, no, it's sort of like... I remember there was a comedian who once did a joke. It was like... He's like, you know, he's talking about some blues musician, the name of whom escapes me. He said, you know, I have all 13 of his albums. As far as I can tell, he's having some trouble with his woman. I keep buying each new album thinking, this is going to be the one, this is going to be the happy album where he gets it all together. He's still having some trouble with his woman. And that's basically like the European carbon scheme. Is like, I keep getting told, no, this is it. This is we've crested the hump, and now we're really going to start seeing massive decreases in emissions, but they're still having some trouble with their woman.
Right.